You're listening to WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 on the dial and globally at WPVMFM.org.
From Feature Story News in Paris, I'm Ross Cullen. Hungary's Pax nuclear power plant is heading for a full shutdown after the River Danube fell to record lows, starving the facility of the cooling water it needs to operate. Hungarian Prime Minister Péter Modrár has called on major companies to reduce their electricity consumption during peak hours. More than 100 towns and villages across Hungary have been placed under water use restrictions as a top-level heat alert remains in force. Here's FSN's Pablo Gutierrez in Budapest.
There's four reactors in that power plant at PAX, and they need the water from the Danube to cool the reactors so they can function. So last week, they were operating at around a 10% capacity. That is very, very serious. As Prime Minister Peter Mayer said, the next 5 days are going to be crucial. He has asked some of the major companies to reduce their consumption.
The Football Association of Wales has become the first national soccer association to publicly withdraw support for FIFA President Gianni Infantino's re-election, citing failures of governance and leadership. The move comes after FIFA was forced on Saturday to abandon its controversial Forward Enterprise plan, which would have allowed private investors to buy stakes in major competitions, a proposal UEFA said crossed a line football's governing bodies should never have crossed. David Bernstein, former chairman of England's Football Association, says the growing opposition to Gianni Infantino, including the departure of his own chief operating officer, could prove impossible to withstand.
We saw his right-hand man, Kevin Lamour, go last week. And for many, many, many outside, I think that will prove irresistible, whether he resigns or whether there's a vote of no confidence or whether it goes to next year to an election, which I presume he would lose. But I think the pressure needs to be absolutely ramped up now, because the quicker this is dealt with, the better. Because frankly, FIFA is being brought into disrepute.
EU officials are meeting on Monday to discuss the latest after the deadly mass border crossing into Spain's North African semi-enclave of Ceuta. At least 72 people died after around 60,000 immigrants surged across the Moroccan border last week, though Spanish authorities say the vast majority have now returned to Morocco. Stephen Bergen, a freelance writer who reports on Spain for The Guardian, says several countries have been accused of involvement.
It seems to have been social media driven, whether it was assisted by malign forces with bots and so on. People have pointed the finger at Israel, the United States, at Russia, any one of whom might have had motives. I mean, certainly Israel and the United States are not happy with Spain's foreign policy attitude.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks, looking today at the extraordinary events late last week in the Spanish enclave of Ceuta on the very tip of Morocco. It looks out across the Straits of Gibraltar and has been a Spanish territory on African soil dating back to the year 1580. By Friday night, 60,000 Moroccan migrants had entered the territory, hoping for a new life in Europe.
A court made a ruling in Spain about migrants being able to come over by sea. The way that was reported, particularly on social media with fake news, was that the border had been opened up.
That's Mark Leonard, co-founder and director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. Those reports about the court verdict were wrong, and the Spanish authorities went into crisis mode to defuse a crisis that saw more than 55 people killed and Ceuta brought to a standstill.
The political ramifications haven't ended yet. The Spanish are very, very upset. And the Spanish Prime Minister has written to the President of the European Commission and the European Council and the Irish Presidency of the EU and asked to have an immediate meeting on video conference of interior ministers to talk about what's going on.
And those political ramifications have been stoked by hard right figures in Europe, suggesting that the rest of the continent might witness another migration crisis sparked by the events, even though the Moroccans have no way of reaching mainland Spain and are now mostly returning home. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And now another look at the top stories. EU officials are meeting on Monday to discuss the latest after the deadly mass border crossing into Spain's North African semi-enclave of Ceuta. Hungary is considering shutting off its sole nuclear power plant due to the record low water levels in the River Danube. And Ukraine has hit another warehouse belonging to one of Russia's biggest online retailers in the latest infrastructure strike away from the front lines. That's the latest feature story news. This is Ross Cullen in Paris reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. We'll start with a mix of clouds and sunshine today. After areas of morning fog, showers and thunderstorms become more likely this afternoon, with highs around 81. Some storms could produce brief heavy downpours. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms remain likely through the evening before tapering off, with patchy fog overnight and lows around 65. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts, advocates, and professionals from across the country sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPVM 103.7, the voice of Asheville, independent, commercial-free radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant and behavioral health expert. With me today is Dr. Stephen DeMille, otherwise known as DeMille, executive director of Red Cliff and Three Peaks Ascent Wilderness Therapy Programs, part of the larger Ascent Behavioral Health Programs family, providing residential and nature-based programs for adolescents in the heart of Utah, where we just were able to be together for a conference out there. Very beautiful. Stephen's connection to the outdoors goes back to his childhood in Las Vegas, where trips into the wilderness of southern Utah, hiking Zion, climbing Veo, shaped his belief that nature is one of the most powerful settings for healing. That belief has guided his career, spanning more than two decades, starting in 2000 as a field guide at Three Peaks Ascent and growing through roles as senior field instructor, field support manager, assistant medical director, primary therapist, and research director before stepping into his current role as executive director. He got a doctorate somewhere in there. Stephen is a licensed mental health counselor with clinical training in experiential therapies, narrative family therapy, Adlerian therapy, and cognitive behavioral therapy, and has worked with adolescents and families across residential treatment, community mental health, and foster care settings. He holds his MA in mental health counseling and a PhD in counselor education and supervision, with research focused on nature-based short-term residential treatment, adolescent development, and counseling ethics, where he presents and publishes at conferences around the world. Outside of his work, he's still outside. Even though he works outside, he's still outside. Dr. Stephen lives just outside Zion National Park with his wife, a former Three Peaks field staffer herself, and their four children, where family time in nature is a constant. Dr. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Todd. I'm glad to be here and looking forward to our conversation.
Excellent. Well, you know, we share a lot of background. I started in this field as a field instructor as well, in a wilderness program, way back in the day. I'm only slightly older than you are. and you know, combining nature with what I felt to be something that's like, how do people heal from the conditions that they suffer from? They find meaning in things. They reconstruct their life around something that means something different, you know, and nature is one of those places that has always carried great meaning for me. It's a place that I just love to spend my time in, and it, you know, in coming into this field in the wilderness approach to, you know, wilderness therapy and healing in wilderness settings and experiential therapies and adventure-based settings, taking that to kids, taking it to adults even, and helping them kind of recraft meaning so they can find something in life that feels like it's really worth living for, that they have some agency in the way that their life is directed, has been like paramount to everything I've ever done and continues to be so. Where did you, and it sounds like you grew up in the woods, or, well, in the desert in your case.
Yeah.
What kicked you off? Like, where did you start? Where was your entry point into this field?
Yeah. So growing up, I had very little exposure experience with the helping or the human services field. So my entry point actually came through the outdoors. And so growing up in Vegas, we don't have wonderful access to the outdoors. So I grew up traveling. We would go to Utah and California and some places that had, you know, places where we go camping and such as a family. Me and a few of my friends started an adventure club in high school. And it was partially an excuse to miss class to go camping. And we also still liked camping. And so it was like a double benefit. And then after I graduated from high school, in a backpacking magazine, there was an advertisement that says get paid to camp and hike. And I was like, all right, you know, I'm used to paying for these activities. I would sure like to get paid to do these things that have cost me money for so long. And it happened to be at a wilderness therapy program. And so shortly after I graduated high school, went out, traveled to Utah, and took my first guiding job working in the human service field. And when I started in wilderness therapy, my attraction there was because I was working in the outdoors, right? So I was doing these 1 to 3 week long treks where we would take these groups of, at the time, we would call them at-risk populations into the backcountry. And we would provide for them these kind of small community living environments where these struggling teens could get and receive feedback in real time, have these impactful experiences, and you know, it's a place for healing and change. And I early, it was actually fairly quickly in my career, my motivation for the work shifted. I started wanting to be in the outdoors. And I quickly realized the thing that actually gave me value in the experience was not just being in the outdoors. It was the types of relationships that were being built with these small groups in the backcountry. I remember there was actually a specific experience I had with this kid who was from New York, had very little outdoor experience, came here, was very insecure, didn't feel like they could do anything. I was working with them one day. They, you know, there was an assignment they had to do. They were supposed to make a primitive fire using a bow drill. This individual thought like, there's no way I'll ever do this. We worked on it for a few, I mean, she had been there for a while, but we had really focused on it for a few days. And when that individual got their first fire, it was like a light bulb went off. It was like a spark ignited in that individual at that in that moment. And
Stephen, are you a metaphor junkie as well?
I think that comes with the territory. But that spark, and then sometimes it's a slow change. But for this individual, it was quick. They went from I can't do this simple activity. And it started to translate into so many other things. It wasn't very long until that person was taking on a leadership role in the community. I mean, the dominoes that fell after that individual had that first success that they genuinely believed they could never do completely transformed their trajectory. And they left there a completely different person. And that experience right there, I was just like, this is more than just the spending time in the outdoors. And so that's when it shifted for me. I was actually on a different career track. I was studying biology, wanted to go into, interested in ecology. And it was my junior year of my undergrad. I was like, I'm switching to psychology. Like, I love the outdoors, but there is something special about the helping and the human service side of what we're doing. So that was my introduction to the field and what got me started on it.
Just as a parallel, I too started, was like a major AP biology guy, walked into college and thought I was going to major in biology, tried doing so for the first year, realized that I not only do I love the outdoors, but telling me that I need to sit in a lab for hours on end was like, I don't think I can do that. And switched to psychology.
My minor ended up being in biology, and my research project, microbiology, I spent a year in a microbiology lab growing bacteria. And that's what did it for me. I was like, I cannot grow another petri dish of bacteria. Dish. Yeah.
Right. I think that we're talking today in the midst of a world that is, from the treatment standpoint, I think our world is in turmoil in all kinds of ways. But the treatment world is in a bit of turmoil. Mm-hmm. That we've got, you know, not just wilderness programs, but also just treatment programs in general. They struggle with census, or they struggle with, you know, finding families that are willing to commit to treatment, even when their child clearly is indicated for it, because they've got all this, the hyperbolic news that's out there from Paris's story to everything else, trying to kill treatment programs. I always I've always said, look, if you want to go and find treatment programs that are doing a really bad job, just go to all your state programs and you mm-hmm. won't have to look very far. But they're coming after they've been coming after private pay folks and, you know, trying to saddle them with all kinds of you're terrible and you do terrible jobs. I'm not saying that our field hasn't had, you know, times of development. You know, you talk about this mm-hmm. first time you went in as a wilderness guide and you were a high school student. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, it's like, well, you know, technical skills can be done by a high school student competently. Processing skills, on the other hand, might require a little more training. You might want that person to have at least an undergraduate degree before they step into a role that they're processing with individuals at that level. So at any rate, our field has, you know, from census to theoretical models and the way that we approach trauma and all the pieces that kind of go into this, I don't think people really understand what treatment looks like. I don't think they understand the depth and breadth of ideology and approach and professionalism and all the things that you really want to consider while you're doing this. You're a person who's, you know, invested yourself in supervision and research, your doctorate, you speak. I've seen you speak across the country. I love watching your presentations. In your mind, if you had a family that's sitting on the fence right now, they've got a child who's, and I love to say this, it's like, well, if you had Paris Hilton as a 15-year-old, what would you have done with her? Keep her in the house? Let her keep running around the way that she was? Probably not. You probably would have wanted to do something. So if you had a family that's sitting on the fence and they've heard all this news on one side, but they're faced with this challenge, this child that they can't control, they need treatment, they're reluctant to press the go button. What is the one or two things or a key piece of information that you would provide for them to weigh in on that decision?
Yeah, there's a few thoughts that I have on that. And the first one, and just I think it addressed just a few. And then I'll try to stay as focused as I can. And you can tell from my introduction that being focused is not my strength. So the first thing that I would want to tell that family is there is no better time to seek out higher levels of treatment care than it is right now. There's no time where it's safer. There's no time in our treatment history where it's more effective. There's no time in our treatment history that it's more efficient in providing the services that we're doing. So the first thing I would want to highlight is they're entering the mental health treatment field at a time where It's you couldn't be entering at a better time. The programs that they're going to be looking at, especially if they're working with a consultant, are going to be programs that are licensed by their state. And we're at a time where many of the states have really professionalized the way that they are overseeing their treatment facilities. The accreditation right now is become standard for mental health, where 10 years ago, you wouldn't see... you wouldn't necessarily see programs that were accredited. Where now, it's unusual to see a program that's not accredited, right? And so the bar has just been risen, and part of that has come from the outside pressures, and part of it has come like the mental health field. If like at any given point, if you look back 30 years, you'd look back and be like, man, we've grown a lot. It's because mental health is one of those fields that is improving, and it's improving in a pretty significant and exponential way. The other thing, in addition, so one thing I'd want to tell that family is there the treatment field is at kind of its prime right now, and my guess is in 20 years, like, it'll be better. But that's one of the cool things about this field is one is you're seeking help, but probably the best that the mental health field has been. The other thing I would want to tell them is early intervention, you're going to have better impact. The earlier you can intervene, the greater impact you'll have. Not only that, the more options you'll have, the longer the distress or dysfunction continues, the more ingrained those behaviors have, the harder it is to disrupt, the harder it is to intervene. There's a saying in some treatment areas that, you know, somebody needs to hit rock bottom before they're willing to train. That's only true if you wait too long. Like, if you can intervene soon, you don't have to get to that rock bottom. You don't have to wait for that individual to be in the hospital fighting for their life before they'll become willing to seek treatment. The other thing is there's a little bit of a narrative out there about the higher levels of care, the residential, the inpatient, that those are, there's like this pushback and saying like, hey, those aren't necessarily needed. All of these things could be treated in a community mental health setting. That is absolutely not true. The experts, the professional societies do not agree with that. That is coming from your social media, but it is not coming from the experts. You know, if somebody needs a higher level of care, needs a residential or an inpatient setting, get them the level that they need. Like, don't
the right level of care, you know?
Yes. Get them the right level of care, get them, match it. One of the worst things you can do is to underserve that individual, because then they're going to have treatment failures. And that will make it harder later when they have a history of treatment failures.
And then they're going to think that treatment doesn't work. And they've got this kind of trauma related to treatment and everything else. We see a lot of families that have got something like that, where they tried to do something that was not enough. It didn't work. And then, you know, they've got this idea about what treatment is, except they've never really, you know, they've gone to Reddit and social media to understand what they're supposed to do. They've not actually consulted with a professional who knows the full breadth and spectrum of treatment. And now they're faced with a situation that things have gotten worse. But what you're saying about, you know, start now, don't wait. You don't have to be in a crisis. It's true across, there's not a condition in the world that's not that's not true. It's like, the earlier you catch it and treat it, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah.
Let's take it another level though. And this is, you know, I want you to be able to speak to this, because while the treatment industry itself has been taking some heat, the wilderness, you know, wilderness and outdoor based experiential programming has taken the most heat, you know. The focus has been, you know, even in the news recently, we saw Provo Canyon, you know, lost their license and had to close and everything else. And, you know, they've been fighting that battle, and I don't think particularly well, for a long time. And there's, you know, you can find bad actors just like you can in any field, which is why we have standards and certifications and all the things that you're talking about. But why wilderness, you know? You got a family, they're sitting on the fence about treatment, and maybe wilderness is the thing that's indicated for them, but they're averse to what they feel to be is the risk that you take by going to an outdoor program versus a facility-based program. Speak to that for us a little bit.
Yeah, so I'll address it in two areas. One is treatment-wise, why, and then I'll speak a little bit to the risk associated with wilderness, that, or the perceived risk associated with wilderness. On one side, you have, so why the wilderness? And so one way that I like to frame this is, one of the things that I think wilderness does better than many of the other treatment settings and environments that I've experienced is the wilderness or outdoor programs are both acknowledging and embracing some of the wisdom traditions of our past. So, like, we've evolved over many years, decades, centuries, millennia. And through that evolution, if you look through the records, we as a species have been going to the outdoors for healing since...
Yeah, since we could write about it, since we took a footstep, right?
Exactly. We were going to the mountains for inspirations. We were going to the valleys for introspection. I mean, we have been going to the outdoors as a healing place, and we're wired to go to the outdoors as a healing place. I remember watching with my kids that Frozen 2, when they're going to the Enchanted Forest, and Olaf just right on the nose says, as they're walking into the Enchanted Forest, he's like, "Enchanted Forests are a place for transformation," or something like that, in his goofy voice. I mean, just like foreshadowing the whole story of like, hey, we're going to go into this Enchanted Forest and we're all going to grow and we're going to come back improved individual. I mean, that's just an archetype. It's just in our, we're wired to find healing there. And there's reasons for that. But wilderness then combines kind of those wisdom traditions of our past with kind of our modern understanding of change and healing. And so you're going and you're having these transformative experiences that we've had you know, since our species has been documenting these experiences. And we're combining it with kind of our modern theories. You mentioned narrative therapy. Narrative therapy is a structured way for us to build a relationship with our stories and to change our relationship with our stories. And there's no better place to do that than sitting around a campfire. You get somebody around a campfire, they won't be able to resist storytelling. That's what you do when you sit around a campfire. Sure. You tell stories. And so taking that, what we understand from our from this narrative therapy approach, and we can help people change their relationships to their stories, help them be able to identify the problems within their stories and adapt their relationships so they're not these problem saturated stories. Another reason for the outdoors is for many individuals, they've had experiences with treatment that hasn't had the impact to redirect them. Because of the novel environment of the outdoors, both in the environment, but the more so in the kind of the social setting is novel. There's just such a high level of interdependence in a wilderness program where you are just highly dependent on your community. The opportunities to give and receive feedback is outstanding. It's particularly impactful. And developmentally for youth, if you want to have impact with youth, it's not going to happen on a one-on-one level. I mean, that's the Adlerian part. Adler believed that individual therapy with youth was a waste of time. It has to be done within a community. That's my beliefs as well. That's why I've attached so much to Adler is like, you got to do it in a peer setting if you're going to work with youth in this kind of hierarchical counseling setting. You're not going to have the impact that you want to have with the youth. And it's particularly potent in a wilderness community. Like I said, if a kid's not doing their part, the community of peers feels it, and that kid gets that feedback at home. If a kid's not doing their part and they stay in bed, their society has created buffers, so the kid just stays in bed. You know, the family gets punished a little bit depending on the state. They might have the school, chastising the parents about the kid not getting up, but the kid is just like, I'm good. I'm going to play video games in the basement. You deal with it. We're in a wilderness setting. That kid isn't insulated from the impact of those behaviors.
It's Ericksonian as well, right?
Like
you get to this, we have this argument about age and development are not necessarily lining up as well these days, but you look at this kind of adolescent age and Erickson's like, they're going to get more from their peers than they are from you. Just beware that your importance as a parent diminishes, your opinion and your importance as a parent diminishes when they turn into teenagers. I certainly have a personal experience with that.
Yep.
I'm sure you do too, but it's like, you can't do it without having their peers around them. Cause that's where they're going to get they're going to get the message.
Yeah. And I love it when I'm on a phone call and I'm doing a family session and the kid goes in there and he's like, guess what I learned this week? I was doing this activity with my peers and somebody said this, and the kid says something that they learned that the parents has been telling them for like the past 4 years. And the parents are like, what do you mean you just learned that? I've been trying to emphasize that for, you know, since you were 8 years old and now you're coming to me, I just learned it. It's like, and I'd have to sit there with the parents like, listen, you know, it's the novel environment. This isn't the first time they've heard it, but it's the first time that they're starting to internalize it.
Well, it's also an intentional social group. You know, when if a kid's getting in trouble and they're going to school, you know, they might be isolating or they're hanging out with kids who are going to support the current behavioral set that they've got going on. Mm-hmm. You pull them out of that environment and you put them around kids who are, you know, getting professional help, being redirected and give, you know, guided conversations and guided peer relationships. And all of a sudden that tone shifts and they start to alter because then you put them in a pool with a positive message instead of a negative one. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to do in a home. That's part of the argument I believe you're making here. It's hard to do in a home when you've got
that. Yeah, and part of the reason it's hard to do in a home is there is something about the familiar environment. When we're in a familiar environment and we're doing what we normally do, whatever maladaptive behaviors we have, it's really hard in a familiar environment for us to experience that differently. When our parents are telling us like, hey, that's not a good idea, or our therapists are telling us that's not a good idea, our teacher. Like when we're in a familiar environment, the consequences of our behavior aren't as noticeable for the individual. And this comes out of the outward bound process model. However, you put somebody in a novel environment like the outdoors, they begin to experience themselves and their impact on others in a different way, simply by changing from a familiar to a novel environment. And that's why you oftentimes hear people say they go on this backpacking trip and they come back with all of these new insights. Well, those insights come in part and heavily because of that novel environment that they're in. They're doing what they normally do, but because it's in a different environment, both community-wise and just environmental in the outdoors, they begin to experience themselves and their decisions differently, which then leads to new insights. And that's why we go to the outdoors for insights. We see things differently when we're in a novel environment. And that's why kids can sometimes say like, oh, I realized this while I was out here, versus why they've missed many opportunities to realize it at home or at school.
So my master's degree is outdoor ed, outdoor experiential ed as well. So you and I are going to, we could just nerd out on
this. I know, we can geek out on this topic.
But, you know, the one thing that I try to tell families when they're contemplating a decision like this is, I say, well, you got to remember that nature is uncompromising. And, you know, my next question to you is going to, let's talk about risk a little bit, but nature is uncompromising, which means that cold is cold, wet is wet, you know, dark is dark, hunger is hunger. And it's not going to relent. You know, you might be in a family environment where boundaries are loose and they've been hard to set, and the person, all these behaviors and familiarity are part of the equation. You go outside and it's like, I'd like to yell at the sun for setting now. Well, you can yell at the sun as long as you like. The truth is the sun does not care and will continue to set. So you might as well plan accordingly. And when you've got that, there's a reliability, there's a safety to knowing what happens, to like, hey, this thing is going to happen whether I like it or not. Now it's on me to prepare. And in that way, like, that's part of this relational message, this experiencing things different that I think that, you know, everyone, including adolescents, and probably is profoundly adolescents, get that message that's like, oh, wow, my agency is in what I can control, not in adjusting the environment, you know, not in the blaming things on the outside of me, but in what I can control. And I think that the place where they, and maybe parents will realize that piece. Maybe they think about it that way. It's like, oh, yeah, no, you're going to build skills, and that's a good thing, and independence and so on. But then they get to the point where they're like, yeah, but it's dangerous in the woods, right? Mm-hmm. It's like there's lions and tigers and bears.
Yes.
So speak a little bit, you know, for a person who's been at every level of the wilderness and experiential programming field and world, and now sitting as executive director of two different programs in a family of programs, even as recently as fires in Utah, one of your groups had to move to a different location so that they could handle those things. Like, talk about managing risk and doing therapeutic work in wilderness settings.
Yeah. So I'll do a conceptual, and I want to talk a little bit about the data as well. So conceptually, when you look at from an adventure therapy lens, one of the ingredients and one of the things that makes adventure therapy impactful is the perceived risk, right? You perceive that, like, hey, when I'm doing this rope course, there's always going to be some risk, but those things are very controlled, and the risk is pretty small. There has to be some significant negligence for there to be an accident. But that perceived risk is important. It brings in a lot of the impact, a lot of the introspection, a lot of those shared experiences where you learn about yourself stuff that you wouldn't have known or couldn't have known. And so there is some of that in the wilderness where there's this perceived risk. It's like, I'm in this unfamiliar environment. I'm outside. There's no walls. What's out there? And so that perceived risk is one of the active ingredients on why the wilderness can have such an impact. And I use the term perceived risk because on one side, there is risk. There are injuries. There are bug bites. There are things that can happen and do happen whether in a wilderness therapy or just out camping with your family and friends. There are things that can happen. You could roll your ankle. You could slip and fall, things like that. However, when you contextualize that risk within The risk of other activities, you can begin to realize like, okay, this, the risk associated with wilderness therapy is no more or less risky than pretty much any other activity that teenagers are doing. So for example, in 2012, Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Council published a study where they took about 10 years of risk data and they said, okay, like what is the risk of participating in wilderness therapy? So kind of the top level comment was like, the participants in wilderness therapy were 2 to 3 times less likely to need definitive care or emergent care than the general population. So when you're just talking about being a teenager in life, wilderness programs had a 2 to 3 times less likelihood of needing to go to that emergency room or care beyond basic first aid, right? And so just looking at the general population, it does happen. However, it's no more, and it's actually less than general adolescents needing that type of care. You know, so that's just general. But when you compare it, like when they compared it to just backpacking guiding companies, you're significantly more likely to be injured just hiring a backpacking guide and going on a hike in Zion. If you look at snow sports, it was significant, 10-20 times less likely to be injured doing a wilderness therapy program than it is to take your family skiing or snowboarding. For sensational value, they looked at football and it was 140 times more likely to get injured playing football than you are in a wilderness therapy program. And I've always wanted them to do cheerleading, because from what I understand, cheerleading is the sport that has the most injuries of any sport. And so, so there is risk. I don't want to diminish that. Like if somebody decides like, hey, I want to go to wilderness therapy, there's going to be an informed consent form that family has to sign that says, hey, there's inherent risks here, risk. And yeah, there are risks. And on one side, the increased perceived risk is important to the healing process. And when you contextualize it to other things, things can happen. However, the rates at which they happen is much lower than oftentimes they get presented or people experience them. And I mentioned that as people, we kind of have this collective unconscious around the outdoors as a place for healing. There's another side to that. We there's this archetype there's around another
collective unconscious, right?
Yeah, there's another dimension here where for a long time, to keep kids from wandering off, we used to tell them scary stories about the woods. So the woods is on one hand a place of healing. On the other hand, a lot of our modern media representations of the outdoors, it's usually like a scary movie. It's just like, like we're going to the woods to camp and then, there's monsters out there, right? And so there's this archetype that it's like it's a scary, dangerous place, and that's also baked into who we are as people, and it tends to get over-exaggerated versus the realities of it, of the actual risk associated with going outdoors. It's much lower, but however, emotionally, we experience that risk as much more emotionally influential than what it actually is.
So I'm thinking about this family we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. This family that's on the fence about treatment. It's like, all right, we've covered if you're being recommended for treatment, you should go get that as soon as you possibly can. And the right level of care. And if residential is indicated, you shouldn't hesitate, pull the trigger, mm-hmm. get it done if you can. And then you're like, okay, well, what about the modality? Okay, well, we've talked about the value of the modality, and you and I could nerd out on that and talk about addiction to metaphors.
Yeah, yes. Until the cows come home. I could keep going. I could keep going. So don't get me started.
Right. And then we talk, well, what's the risk? It's like, well, if you survive the drive to and from there, then you probably,
yep. That's the riskiest thing you'll do. Yep.
The riskiest thing you do is drive there. Let's be clear. Mm-hmm. You got in a car today and you survived the experience, then you're probably going to be do just fine in wilderness therapy. So let's get a little nuanced for a second before, we run out of time, because you and I could probably just spend hours about this.
Yeah.
We get to the place where the abuse and neglect have happened, and it's happened in the past. We know mm-hmm. that it has. There's been bad actors. And even as a field, there was a period of time when, wilderness was used as a methodology to work with at-risk teens, and by at-risk teens, I'm talking court-referred teens. I'm talking mm-hmm. kids that were in pretty serious trouble. They were doing that as an alternative to jail, is what they were doing. And, you know, there was a very punitive style basis that came out of that ideology that where a lot of the field started. It's like, you know, the whole tough love, and you're going to sweat it out, and you're going to grind it out, and you're going to be uncomfortable, and you know, you're going to be in danger, and nobody's going to coddle you kind of ideology. And you saw things like, you know, bad staffing ratios and withholding food and abuse scenarios where, you know, kids were being abused and things like that. Now, you mentioned, of course, right now there's no better time because our field is in general is at its height. You know, not only are we seeing a lot more people going to treatment, like there's a lot of research, there's a lot of data, there's a lot of training, there's a lot of certification, all the things that go into this. Speak to what it's like to manage, you know, and I've said this about wilderness before. It's like wilderness is incorruptible. Now you've got people who can do it badly.
Yes.
You got bad therapists. You got people that don't know how to maintain safety when they're doing field guide kinds of roles and things like that. Stuff exists and has happened in the past. We've seen it. Mm-hmm. How is it that you manage your staffing, both clinical, technical, and otherwise in conducting safely, not only just like physical safety, but emotional safety for the adolescents that you serve in your programs? What's the trick there in your mind?
Yeah. And it starts from, so let me take a step back. You mentioned some of the bad actors. One of the things, probably one of the biggest missteps in the wilderness therapy field was there were some very early influential individuals that came from maybe a more punitive militaristic background that said, hey, you know, boot camps are good. Let's do boot camps in the wilderness. And so they brought in some of the deprivation, some of the kind of breakdown to build up philosophies that did exist. Some of the more adversive behavioral kind of exposure kind of stuff that don't work. They don't work for youth. They don't work, you know, for treatment. However, there were some very early influential.
We commonly refer to it all as behavior mod, right? You know,
yes,
the behavior mod days.
Right. And so those pieces came in, weren't effective. The deprivation, deprivation models were very sensational. And a lot of times when you're seeing like the media coverage on it, they're focusing on those early programs that had a very poor philosophical origin, right? Now, one of the things that's happened is those programs have moved away from those models, and they've embraced the best practices of the relevant fields. And so the reason that there are so few injuries and illnesses is because the medical best practices for wilderness therapy are extremely robust. You know, we're tracking calorie intake of our participants. We're tracking water consumption on a daily basis. They're seeing medical professionals, nurses, doctors, throughout their treatment. Like there's not going to be a time where that kid is like, they're going to have EMT level trained staff overseeing them on a daily basis with daily medical logs. Like they are going to be they're so closely monitored that we're able to catch things really quickly. You know, we've had cases where, you know, kids had these budding health concerns outside of anything that had to do with air. We caught them really quick and were able to get them to the hospital, get them care that probably they wouldn't have caught as quickly if they were at home. Right. And it's because we have very robust medical best practices in our space now. In addition, we've adopted the clinical best practices of the treatment field, and so our theories of change that are happening in wilderness therapy right now are coming out of the best practices in the mental health field that are informing the way that we're engaging with and providing the services that we're providing now and integrating the outdoor experiences with these various theories of change and clinical models, and so it's. Yeah. And so because of the adoption of more modern best practices, the services are so much different than oftentimes how they're represented, which is one of the problems that we're running into right now is when people characterize the field, they characterize the field as it was 30 years ago, and it doesn't even come close to accurately representing what the experience is like currently.
Well, and you know, we were just at a conference together, and you had representatives of the state legislature there in Utah. Mm-hmm. I was impressed that they showed up, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And you know, even in the words that they're saying, and that, you know, they're a little bit, it was lip service. They're obviously there in front of this group, you know, and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. But